for those affected by it, very significant circumstance. We're going to look at agenda paper 12 now. And really the focus on the discussion here is not to keep going back to what we were discussing yesterday about multiple use of IFRS 1, but to focus specifically on the issues of chronic hyperinflation and the horrendous consequences that has on people who are enthusiastically embracing IFRS but then find that they can't comply with it. So, Toshi, if you'd like to tee this up for us.
Thank you. Agenda paper 12 deals with requests for guidance on how an entity should resume presenting a financial statement in accordance with IFRS after a period when it could not comply with IAS 29. The request identifies an entity whose functional currency is the currency of a hyperinflationary economy. The entity is unable to IAS 29 because the general price index relating to functional currency is unavailable, and functional currency lacks exchangeability. The entity's functional currency changed to non-inflationary, hyperinflationary currency. The request specifies the entity specifically asks the committee for guidance on how an entity should present opening statement of financial position and what an entity should present for its comparative financial statement after this change in functional currency. For the first question, view A, starts in paragraph 22, IAS 29 should be amended. Proponent of this for this view believe that this issue should be dealt with as specific case, and the amendment should be applied to only entities which no longer comply with IAS 29. They also believe this amendment should apply a measurement approach that is consistent with other IFRS standards such as IAS 21 and IAS 29. The second view B believe that entities should apply IFRS 1 because this is one of a number of cases in which an entity is required to apply IFRS 1 more than once. They don't believe this case should be dealt with specifically outside of IFRS 1. The staff support view A because this approach is able to avoid some other issues that may arise in applying IFRS 1. This includes concerns relating to how IFRS 1 would be applied to a parent or an investor in an entity operating in such a hyperinflationary economy, and the impact or lack of comparatives has on the entity's ability to apply IFRS. As for comparative information, the staff supports the view that IFRS should not provide additional guidance on presentation of comparatives in this situation, because the staff are concerned whether an alternative format of presentation of comparatives could always meet the purpose of financial statement in IAS 1 to provide the information that is useful to a wide range of users. Staff also concerned whether the entity may be required to apply IFRS 1 after in subsequent reporting period after applying the amendment to IAS 29. This is because the subsequent set of financial statement may represent an entity's first IFRS financial statement. The staff do not believe it would be appropriate for an entity to apply IFRS 1 after applying the proposed amendment to IAS 29. Consequently, the staff propose amending the scope of IFRS 1 to exclude this application of this standard in the specific situation. The staff recommendation begins from paragraph 58, the agenda paper. Based on the agenda criteria assessment and annual improvement criteria assessment, staff recommends the board, the staff recommends the committee should not add this issue to its agenda. However, the staff proposes the committee recommends the board make a separate amendment to IS-29 and IFRS-1. This would address a more timely basis because staff believe this issue is urgent and time-sensitive. Does the committee agree with staff recommendation, or does the committee have any comment or suggestion?
All right, thanks, Toshi. As I said, I want to deal with the first issue, and that's the question of whether or not we should make an amendment to IS-29. So, do we have anybody that has any questions for the staff on that? Jean-Louis?
In my view, the problem is so substantial that I have a doubt whether it would be sufficient to make an amendment to IS-29 to change the situation. I believe that we are in a situation then really the we cannot prepare in the type of hyperinflation situation you mentioned, IFRS compliant set of accounting of financial statements. So we have to restart again a full process of presenting IFRS compliant figures, going through IFRS 1, and so meaning that first time is more than once, and that's my view, and I believe that we cannot solve really the problem of comparative information, because in my view you cannot make anything that would make sense as comparative figures except wait another year in order to have two successive years in conformity with IFRS.
Okay, Jean-Louis, you sort of answered three questions in one there. I was just wanting to focus on the first one. From what I heard you saying, you were concerned that the amendment to IS-29 proposed in itself would be enough. But really the question is, would that amendment to IS-29 actually assist in alleviating the situation? Would it address part, at least, if not all of the concern?
It's only a part of it. So we need to go through IFRS 1, 2.
Okay. Scott?
I'm having trouble with the amendment to IAS-29 and separating that from the IFRS 1 issue, because we've stated that for a period the company in question here was not preparing IFRS statements because it couldn't comply with IAS-29. Seems to me if they then start preparing IFRS statements, they're covered by IFRS 1. If we think they can't apply IFRS 1 as written, which I would submit might be possible because they can't even get a historical cost for inventory, which I think there is probably not an exception for in IFRS 1, I think we need to amend IFRS 1 to say if you have chronic hyperinflation in back periods and therefore you can't do historical cost of current non-monetary assets, then you can do fair value or whatever we think is necessary. I don't think amending IAS 29 accomplishes anything, especially as written. We're saying in order to qualify for this amendment in IAS 29, you have to have been on IFRS, gone off because of chronic hyperinflation, and then come back. What if you never got on IFRS because you always had chronic hyperinflation? Seems to me when you come on to IFRS, you face exactly the same issues as the company that was on and then went off due to chronic hyperinflation, but we're not going to let you qualify for this amendment. If we believe that the past existence of chronic hyperinflation makes it too hard to comply with IFRS 1 as written, we need to think about amending IFRS 1 to make the necessary allowances for a company that cannot comply with IFRS 1 as written. I don't think amending IAS 29 is the answer here. The alternative, if we wanted to do this through IAS 29, would be to find a way to amend IAS 29 so that when a company, when a company is located or has a functional currency in a position like Zimbabwe's, that they don't have to stop complying with IFRSs. In other words, amend IAS 29 to essentially say, by the way, if you can't do everything that, that we've said in the previous 30 paragraphs because the following six things all happened at the same time, here's what you do to still have IFRS financial statements. And perhaps what you do there is reset everything to fair value or, you know, whatever we decide it is. But I think that would be in context of amending IAS 29 so that companies in this situation never have to say we're off of IFRS. They can say we're still complying with IFRS. Here's the requirements to apply IFRS in our situation.
Maybe I should just illustrate a couple of points then, because there's maybe an assumption immediately. This is why I tried to say leave first-time adoption out of this. There are some businesses that have continued to operate during chronic hyperinflation and for peculiar reasons, perhaps, compared to everybody else, but are able to continue to produce information to comply with IFRS 1. So they haven't actually gone off. They're in the same jurisdiction. There are many other companies that have major subsidiaries operating in this area of chronic hyperinflation. The parent and the group, of course, haven't gone off IFRS 1. They may have had to take some exceptions for the uncertainty, audit exceptions, or whatever the correct term is. I'm not an auditor, but so don't criticize me on
not
that.
Not an auditor either.
But they've continued. And so the question is not just for those entities that were on IFRS, came off, and are going back in their entirety. It's those that have come out of hyperinflation, but have still managed to assert compliance, whether they've got an audit exception or not, and also for those groups that have subsidiaries that are not going to be first-time adopters that also have to deal with this issue. And that's why I was trying to get the focus on, would something in IAS 29 itself address something that was specific to chronic hyperinflation for those that are affected by it? I think it's difficult to know in the circumstances when you're experiencing it actually what we can say you can do that continues to comply with IFRS, as opposed to if you've got the problem, you can't comply, this is the way back. Now, maybe we just tell them, always assert, don't come off. We give them a buy in 29. That isn't the staff proposal, but you know, that if you do have chronic hyperinflation, you must just express that your financial statements are completely meaningless because there is no basis of coming up with this. It's hard to say if you've got completely meaningless financial statements that complies with IFRS. That's why I'm hesitant in going there. But I know it's difficult to separate this from the first-time adoption issue, but if you can please just focus on the hyperinflation aspect and for the emergence out of hyperinflation and how to present information that is both useful to investors, informative to investors at the time of the change to something that is more stable, and also something that is or meets the cost-benefit test in the terms of cost and effort to derive those numbers.
In that case, I'll focus then on the first thing I said, which is that the requirement to have previously been on IFRS seems superfluous to me. The issue is you weren't on IFRS most recently because of chronic hyperinflation. You're coming out. What do you do? It shouldn't be a requirement to qualify for whatever relief we give that you had previously been on IFRS at some point before.
In fact, the qualification is that you were unable to assert that you were on it.
Because of chronic hyperinflation. Right?
Yeah. Okay, I think we can dissociate from that. Joanna?
I'm not convinced that this works, or that it is the right place to put it. In terms of and very specifically with this specific example in place, 38B talks about the entity's functional currency may change to a currency of a non-hyperinflationary economy, which this one has done, i.e. it's they because effectively they've they've gone to US dollars. So it's non-hyperinflationary. But what, I mean, there are circumstances, it could easily have been that Zimbabwe sorted itself out and that it was still hyperinflationary, but it just wasn't chronic hyperinflationary. So to me, we've almost been too narrow in that, why would you actually, I mean, I turn it around, why would you go to 29 now? I'm not hyperinflationary anymore. I've got a US dollar. Which has got nothing to do with 29. So why would I go there? And I'm sorry, I can't de-link this from IFRS 1 and the decision that we made earlier, because the decision we made earlier is for whatever reason you came off IFRS, you must use IFRS 1 again. If we do this within 29, I think that we are causing an awful rod for our and future colleagues' backs by almost giving exceptions to, well, you can do it just within this standard or you can do it just within that standard. And I just think that that is incredibly dangerous. And I honestly think that the situation can be solved through IFRS 1, probably better than it actually can through this. I'm just not
convinced. Can you explain to me, Joanna, how a company that is a group that has a significant subsidiary that's been suffering from hyperinflation can benefit from a change to IFRS 1?
Well, I would argue that one that has a significant subsidiary that has been on chronic hyperinflation cannot benefit from this because its financials, consolidated financial statements can't be compliant with IFRS. And therefore,
now, the extent of compliance or non-compliance is a matter of judgment for the financial statements overall. But if that group asserts compliance with IFRS, then it doesn't meet your test for being able to use IFRS 1 again. I keep saying, will you put IFRS 1 out of your mind? We'll discuss that. Joanna, we'll discuss that in a moment. The staff had a recommendation yesterday on IFRS 1, which we changed. So in the light of that, the staff recommendation in this paper is also up for debate later, whether you want to make it consistent with yesterday's decision or not. I'm asking you the question, if you think that the amendment to IS-29, the hyperinflationary standard, is something that will address the circumstances in here. The staff think it does, based on their outreach with the people that are suffering from it. You think it doesn't, okay? That's fine. Ruth?
I'm thinking about whether I agree with what Joanna said about this no longer being an IS 29 issue. It's actually a transition from 29 to 21. So where would the company go to look to, what do I need to do now? I need to translate my numbers into US dollars. I'm not hyperinflationary, so I'm in IS 21. And thinking about what Scott said as well, trying to de-link it from IFRS 1, and I understand the reasons why. Perhaps the answer is in the link between IAS 29 and IAS 21 that we need to give the relief. That we would say, when you, regardless of what's happened, and whether you said you couldn't comply with IFRS, and therefore you didn't assert compliance, or whether your financial statements were qualified by the auditor who said you don't comply with IFRS, because that's possible, in which case you can't be a first-time adopter under IFRS 1. So I understand that it is a different situation. Then perhaps the answer to the problem is either the by or the past that Scott suggests in IAS 29, but I think it needs to be linked to IAS 21 to say when this happens and you have to move to another currency, you can restate your new balances at fair value as deemed cost when you move there. I think that might solve some of the problem for the companies that still asserted compliance with IFRS throughout that period, or whose accounts were qualified by the auditor, that might help them. For those that said, I'm not complying with IFRS at all, I've gone off IFRS and I'm going to come back on again, then I think they can be repeat first-time adopters under IFRS 1, and perhaps IFRS 1 then needs to have an exception or exemption in it that links to the new relief that we're going to provide in IS 21, possibly. So I think I don't agree with the staff recommendation, but I think there's another way out of it.
Okay. Peggy?
I originally was in the same camp as most of the people, just amend IAS 1. But in thinking about the situation you outlined, Bob, in terms of a subsidiary of a company, and it might not be a big subsidiary, but it could end up having an impact, say, on a segment of a big company that could stand out and could affect then particular results in a quarter or going forward as you've changed the value of your assets that are on the balance sheet that are now getting amortized. So I think I would now lean towards amending this standard and not going back to one.
Andrew?
I didn't have any real issue with the staff recommendation as regards IAS 29. I did have a couple of, I'm not sure how significant they are, but practical issues. The proposed amendments talked about using fair value as a deemed cost basis for non-monetary items. It doesn't, I don't think it says what the measurement basis would be for monetary items, at least I didn't think so. And then it also talks about for monetary items, translating them from the old hyperinflationary functional currency into the new functional currency at the relevant exchange rate, but there won't be a meaningful exchange rate at that point in time, or maybe the answer is that monetary assets and liabilities in the old currency are worthless anyways, and maybe the answer is nil. But you know, there's a couple of practical issues there I think you need to think about if you're going to go down this route before you finalise the drafting.
Thanks. Laurence, your light was on before.
Yeah. I believe we need several amendments, amongst which one for IAS 29, going for fair value. I agree with Andrew that we need to clarify what to do with monetary assets and liabilities as well, and equity as well. Because in the past, I recall some issues about how do you restate equity when you have been hyperinflationary and so on. So it's a whole balance sheet we need to look at. As for the other amendments relating to IFRS, when we discussed before, I do not support the staff proposal, and I will express further things.
Okay, thank you. Guido?
Well, I was, in general, I was happy with the staff's proposal. I think it's a good way to address this issue. One or two issues that we may think about the comparatives. I've seen that there are a lot of options, but maybe we could, I don't know, maybe we could agree on one or two of these options that make the comparatives more comparable to what we had. The other thing is, I think it's the last 38D in the new IAS 29, as it is proposed in the paper. We need to clarify to which periods IFRS 1 does not apply here, because I think we have two issues here. One is when we, in the first year where we use this new functional currency, where we don't have comparatives, which is then not in compliance with IFRS, and then the next year after that, because you could apply IFRS 1 to both of these periods. But otherwise, I think it's a good solution to the problem that we face.
Ben?
I agree with Andrew's and Guido's comments, and I was pretty happy with the staff recommendation. And what I found quite interesting and what convinced me that we can differ from our yesterday's discussion on IFRS 1 was what Peggy said yesterday, that the IFRS 1 situation we tackled yesterday is something that might happen quite frequently and is within the reach of the company or within the company's decision or the investor's decision. And this is something, hyperinflation is not something that we hopefully experience on a wide range of companies and wide range of countries. So and it is something that is beyond the influence of the companies. So I think we can, I for myself can live with this inconsistency with our yesterday's decision if we change the standard in the way that is presented here.
Thanks. David or Toshi, you've heard the comments from the members of the committee. Do you have any observations or responses you would like to make?
I think Bob articulated one of the main concerns
that came across in some of the dialogue we've had with some of the constituent groups affected here, and that does relate to dealing with the investor situation and how you could blend that in with IFRS 1. So I think in terms of key drivers for the staff, I call it moving away from IFRS 1 here, it was that fact pattern. I think secondly, I heard Ruth talk about interaction between 21 and 29. I think that is certainly something we've thought about. I think in our draft wording, we tried to make that connection. And I think we also, potentially in the paper, opened up, well, maybe this is something you could do through 21. We don't explore that further in the paper, but it was something we thought through. Because I think in the fact pattern we're dealing with here, the change in functional currency is important. It's an important part of the fact pattern here. Picking up on Andrew's point, it means you do have some form of sort of exchange rate for monetary items on that opening balance sheet date. Now, to your point, it may well be there's zero, but you do have something you can point to at that point in time. Either way we go, there's some additional practical issues here around coming up with fair value amounts, for example, and some more detailed application points to be thinking about. So this is going to be challenging, but I think the staff view is that we certainly like to be able to do something here that's going to be helpful and give a path back onto IFRS. And I think the staff view was that we think doing it through 29 keeps it narrow to this specific fact pattern and achieves that objective.
Yeah, I think one other thing to just keep in mind is, although, yes, if the companies come off IFRS, then when it comes back onto IFRS 1, then it would automatically be within the scope of IFRS 1 unless any changes were made to IFRS 1 to exclude it. Now, the submission that we received put forward the proposal, well, perhaps one of the routes to consider would be an IFRS 1 route. IFRS 1, though, of course, doesn't give any exemptions from hyperinflation. So any company that is transitioning to IFRS is required to consider for all of its non-monetary assets, has it gone through in the past a period of hyperinflation, and to feed that into their assets that they record on their opening balance sheet. And so if we were to go down an IFRS 1 route, then we'd need to consider that broader aspect of IFRS 1 as well.
Thanks, Michael. Scott, you wanted to come in?
Yeah, I mean, the issue of, what if it's a subsidiary that is going through this problem? I guess it seems to me that the consolidated group in that situation would be in one of three situations, I think. Either one, the subsidiary was large enough and significant enough that the group could not assert compliance with IFRS. In that case, an IFRS 1-based solution would work for the group as well as it works for the standalone entity. Number two, the subsidiary that was subject to chronic hyperinflation was small enough that despite the lack of a currency peg, the consolidated financial statements were asserted to be in compliance with IFRS, and because of immateriality or being able to put bounds on the potential size of the error, everybody got comfortable with it. They just asserted compliance, got a clean auditor's opinion. Well, in that case, they don't need a solution. If it was immaterial, then it'll be immaterial when it comes back into having a functional currency that has exchangeability. So the third situation is the one Ruth described. The company asserted compliance with IFRS. The audit report said no. That company shouldn't have asserted compliance with IFRS. that seems to be a fairly small group of companies that the company refused to admit it wasn't in compliance with IFRS, but the auditor thought that it wasn't. I'm not sure we need to craft a solution that works for such a company. So I think that looking at it through IFRS 1 would work for most of the consolidated situations that this would come up as well.
Then if you're saying that IFRS 1 is the solution, then how do you address Michael's observation that IFRS 1 doesn't grandfather the hyperinflation?
When I spoke earlier, I said if we think that a company coming out of chronic hyperinflation can't apply IFRS 1 as written, and we want to make some changes so that they can come on to IFRS, I would prefer making the changes to IFRS 1. Say if you're coming out of chronic hyperinflation, here is another exemption from the normal requirements.
All right. Now, just before we get too excited about that, we've been using a term, chronic hyperinflation, which is not a defined term in IFRS.
Understood.
Hyperinflation is a defined term. The way in which we've identified chronic hyperinflation is that it is a hyperinflationary economy that has certain characteristics. For example, there is no exchangeability of the currency, that there is no reliable index or anything else. You're almost forcing it back into position that you have to have been a previous adopter to know whether you were involved in a hyperinflationary economy at the time or not, as the test that chronic hyperinflation is really defined in this paper as you were on IFRS and because of circumstances you were forced to move off IFRS. Now, if you think that with the benefit of hindsight you could actually come to that same conclusion in any other circumstance, now, chronic hyperinflation, I think we're talking about here, I don't know in terms of numbers when it goes into the gazillions and way beyond, but my understanding is that there was, let's say the measure was reflected in a devaluation of the currency over a period of just over a year by removing 23 zeros from a number. Now, I can't conceive of what that actually means. Perhaps, you know, for those who are interested in the cultural pursuits, it's best expressed that by the time you go into a bar and order your second drink, its price is increased by 50%. Now, obviously, that depends on how quickly you drink. Guido.
I'm afraid that two of the situations described by Scott cannot be covered by IFRS 1. And starting with the third one, paragraph 4A in IFRS 1 tells you that this situation does not fall within IFRS 1, so you can have a statement in your financial statements that it's in compliance, even if the auditor says no, it would not fall in IFRS 1. And the second part where you have this small subsidiary with this hyperinflation problem and you still think it's in accordance with IFRS 1, I think you still need then something in IAS 29 that tells you how to account for this small subsidiary when it comes out of this hyperinflation situation. So I don't think that these situations are could be solved in IFRS 1. That's why I think IAS 29 is the right way to deal with it.
Laurence?
Those who claim compliance with IFRS and still had an auditor's qualification are not necessarily always groups. I know that in some jurisdictions, some environments, you have a legal requirement to apply IFRS. And so you have no choice. You cannot say that you cannot apply IFRS. Otherwise, you'll be fine. I mean, this is a situation in Europe. Legally, when you are listed, you must. So sometimes the situation is not that clear. And so this is why I support both amendments to IAS 29 and amendments to IFRS 1, because IFRS 1 surely, when it was developed, never ever contemplated the situation, this unique situation that we are facing. And so we need to have, to solve it.
Lance, I agree. When we're developing IFRS 1 and probably IAS 29, we'd never envisage anything like this. And from a personal point of view, I hope that we never see it ever again, not in my lifetime, not in anybody's lifetime. So in a way, we're addressing an issue that we're not expecting to recur, but it is a fairly significant issue at the moment. Joanne?
Just to say, I actually support exactly what Scott says, and I don't believe that in considering interpretations or anything that we should be considering the situation where there is a qualified audit report, because I think that applies to a whole heap of different situations.
We're considering chronic inflation. We're not considering ordered opinions.
But we're talking about that.
We're talking about first-time adopters.
Yes, but we're
talking about the issue in 29. Please, can we get back to it?
And we're talking about one of the situations is the third situation where you have claim compliance and the auditors say that you don't.
No, sorry, that is an IFRS 1 issue. If you can't stick to the point, please can we just move on?
Okay.
The issue that I'm asking you to consider is one that relates to chronic hyperinflation.
Okay.
And an entity, whether it had asserted or not, that was suffering from chronic hyperinflation, take the example that Guido mentioned, of a subsidiary within a group that has been in a hyperinflationary situation, it's not sufficiently material to cause a qualification in the group audit opinion, but it now comes out of hyperinflation. It has a disconnect between the numbers that had been booked before and the numbers it's reporting now.
Okay,
the subsidiary might well qualify for first-time adoption, but the group doesn't. So the group has to have a continuation. So how do you deal with the opening numbers when you can actually translate those opening numbers into something that can be included in the group financial statements? So I think those that have wanted to express a view of now express that view. So there is a staff recommendation in here, which is to propose an amendment to IS 29. Can I ask if anybody objects to pursuing an amendment to IS 29? That's not to say you have to agree with the words that are in the proposed amendment at the moment, but that's the approach that the staff is recommending, an amendment to 29. Does anybody object to that?
Yes, I do.
Right, so there's one objection, so the majority would agree with that approach. Can I now turn to the second issue? And forgive me, Toshi and David, that I'm going to introduce this because your recommendation was different, but following on from the discussion that we had yesterday, which is that IFRS 1 should be applied in circumstances where in a previous year an entity had not asserted compliance with IFRS, and this year it was presenting IFRS compliance statements, that in the circumstances in which that entity at one stage had been an adopter of IFRS and had discontinued solely for the reasons it was suffering from chronic hyperinflation and it could not provide the information in compliance with IFRS, that it was now moving back into the IFRS world, your decision yesterday would seem to indicate that you would recommend that it be allowed to use IFRS 1 in the year in which it readopts IFRS. Does anybody have any comments, observations to make on that? Sorry, Laurence.
If it went off IFRS, it is required to apply IFRS 1.
Required. That's the decision yesterday.
Yeah.
Ruth?
Well, I think if we agree with, or we don't object to, the staff's recommendation on IS 29, in order to be consistent with our decision yesterday, we have to make an exception for IFRS 1 in the circumstance. So we have to specifically say that in this particular circumstance, IFRS 1 does not apply, which is written into para 38D of the staff recommendation. So I think that is the right answer. That is consistent with our conclusion yesterday, which says you must apply IFRS 1 unless you're told not to. 38D is saying you must not apply IFRS 1. The proposed staff recommendation in para 38D says an entity shall not apply IFRS 1 in circumstances.
I'd say in the light of yesterday's decision, where you seem to be encouraging anybody who's in the anybody who had not asserted compliance in the previous year, regardless of whether they had complied in an earlier year, but if they hadn't complied in the previous year, and there was no explicit statement, they were making an explicit statement of compliance this year that they would be required to use IFRS 1. Yep. That was yesterday's decision. What I'm testing is, do you want that still to apply?
Ah, right, I see.
So, well, not to make an exception to it, but do you want that to be the requirement?
In other words, do you want to test our decision yesterday that IFRS 1 is required to be applied
yes.
every time you move in and out of IFRS?
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Do you want time to think about
it? I think we still want to stick with that. But I think we need to make an exception for the circumstance because it would be inconsistent. Our decision today would be inconsistent with our decision yesterday if we didn't make the exception that the staff are proposing, which is you would ordinarily be required to comply with IFRS 1 if you were in this situation, but we're making an exception. I'm not sure whether 38D is the right place to put it or whether it needs to go into IFRS 1, but that's, you know, the staff can have a look at it, but I think we have to make the exception.
All right, so just to be clear, you're saying that you don't think somebody who has previously suffered chronic hyperinflation should be permitted to use IFRS 1 when they readopt?
No, I think that if we're going to make the change to IS 29, which says when you come out of it and you go to another currency, this is what you do, then I think we have to make the exception that says, and you don't go to IFRS 1 as a first-time adopter. Because ordinarily, if we didn't say that, applying our decision yesterday, you would have to go to IFRS 1. So what that says is that I agree with what the staff have said in making the exception in para 38D.
Okay,
their recommendation.
Guido?
I was actually thinking what's the difference in this situation to the situations that we have discussed yesterday. My first view was, well, there shouldn't be an exception. But I, thinking about it more deeply, I think the reason why I would also agree with having an exception to the rule that we have decided on yesterday is that even if we would say you could apply IFRS 1, I'm struggling to see how you could do that in this situation. So then you would need to have a lot of exceptions and exemptions in IFRS 1, maybe just one rule. If you apply IFRS 1 in this situation, just take the fair values as it is written here in IS 29. I mean, we could deal with that issue in this way too, but I think if we said you are allowed or you have to apply IFRS 1 in this situation, we would have to have then a lot of exceptions and exemptions in IFRS 1 to this situation because you simply don't have the numbers in order to apply IFRS 1 in this situation as it is written now. So I would, looking at all this, I would say yes, I would stick with the rule we had yesterday, but we need to have an exception or exemption from IFRS 1 for this situation. That could be within IFRS 1 or 29. I think it's better in IFRS 1. I agree with Ruth on that.
My presumption is that the amendment to 29 that the staff will propose to us at some stage would enable the entity that previously had suffered chronic hyperinflation to have financial statements, opening financial statements. It will be able to derive all of those numbers, in which case, because IFRS 1 currently requires somebody that has previously experienced hyperinflation, chronic or otherwise, that they have to go back and adjust their non-monetary assets in accordance with the requirements of IS 29, and IS 29 has been amended in a way that enables them to produce the numbers, that we wouldn't have to make any changes to IFRS 1 at all. But maybe my understanding isn't the same as the staff's on that, so maybe we can ponder on that. I'll take some more comments. Peggy?
I'm fine with the proposal as is, except I do think that with respect to the discussion yesterday and Scott's suggestion just changing the name of IFRS 1 to just adoption of International Accounting Standards, I think would go a long way here. And eliminate a lot of this confusion. The other thought I had too is with so many countries just coming on to IFRS in the next couple of years, and you could have a situation where a country changes to IFRS and companies aren't able to prepare the financials in IFRS, you know, in that year that they're supposed to because of a situation like that. I mean, I'm just thinking very broadly. So just caution us to make sure that whatever wording we use is wide enough that it would encompass other situations like that.
Okay. Thank you. Scott?
I was originally pressed the button to say what you just said, that if we amend IAS 29 to say here's what you do when you come out of chronic hyperinflation, then I think you can just apply IFRS 1 because that part of IAS 29 would be part of your consideration. And I prefer to leave it within IFRS 1 because then the framework for the required disclosures as you come on to IFRS is there rather than being exempt from that, and then we'd have to rethink what disclosures we might want the company to make. My preference is to leave it within IFRS 1, but somehow allow them to take advantage of this special circumstance, which I think if we put it into IAS 29, then it would all work together to allow them to do it. So I was in the same place as you, Bob. I think if we amend IAS 29, we don't need to exempt them from IFRS 1, but maybe the staff can report back on whether the words actually do work like that once we get it in there.
Okay. Laurence?
I am in the same position that he's, I'm not sure that, first of all, I would like to understand the concerns of those who believe that IFRS 1 should not be applied. Because I do believe that the conjunction of the amendment to IS 29 and IFRS 1 would help things work. But I would like further time to think whether we are missing something. Currently, I'm thinking that we have an issue with the comparatives, because IFRS 1 requires the comparatives to be restated. And we will have the issue of the comparatives if we want these to be applied quickly. So we need to think a little bit more of the interaction within the two, but my first feeling is that perhaps IFRS 1 is okay, as it is.
John?
I also would feel more comfortable to go through IFRS 1. I believe IFRS 1 has a large scope and deals with a number of issues for first-time adopter or for adopters. And find a way to cross-reference to IS 29 if that can be done in a simple manner, that I would feel more comfortable with this approach, and it would be more consistent with what we've decided yesterday.
Okay. Andrew? Bob, cool down. Yes, I'll call you in a moment, Luca.
Sorry, I'm a little bit confused. I'm a little bit confused now. If we take your group situation and we amend IS 29 as is in this proposal, does that mean, are we now thinking we don't need to amend? We don't need to build an exception to IFRS 1, or we still do? I'm not quite sure.
No, the proposal is, especially if we, but this is not a decision that we've made to change IFRS 1 to adoption of IFRS, but that's effectively the thought process that we had yesterday. So if we make the amendment to IS 29, that should address the group situation that we were talking about earlier. It doesn't of itself necessarily affect the underlying entities. So it may be that IS 29 itself, for the separate entity that suffered from this, has got enough relief within 29 itself. The question is, do we now want to go one step further, having said that anybody who doesn't assert compliance in a previous year and now adopts IFRS is permitted to use IFRS 1, but then make an exception in the circumstances that you'd suffered the ravages of economic decline and catastrophe, and as a result of that you weren't allowed to use IFRS 1? I have a little difficulty in knowing why we would want to make an exception to IFRS 1 and how we'd articulate that in the basis. In the light of the decision that we made yesterday. If we'd come up with a different decision yesterday, then we wouldn't have had to think, perhaps, quite as hard about this exception. It would have fitted into other categories that where it was or was not permissible. But in this circumstance, I have some trouble in understanding why we would want to prohibit somebody from using IFRS 1 when they were adopting this year, having not adopted it or not asserted compliance in the previous year. David?
I think one of the challenging issues here, if the entity could apply IFRS 1 as well, and Guido talked around this, is can it really apply IFRS 1 as currently written? So if I was to pick on one piece here, IFRS 1 talks about, let's say, reconciliations to previous gap. Well, we don't have previous gap here. We do not have that information, so we'd have to do something with that. There's, I think, maybe some others in there, so I do think that if we would be saying in this situation you would apply IFRS 1 at a later date, that we're going to need to put something in IFRS 1 around how we would apply IFRS 1 at a later date.
Jana?
Just in response to that, David, that applies whether or not you've come in or out. Like if somebody, as Peggy says, is going into IFRS tomorrow or next year, and they happen to have one of these subsidiaries, or they happen to be coming out of hyperinflation, they've got to deal with it, full stop. So it's arguably a hole in IFRS 1 right now. So it's not the in and out bit, because they've got they've got to apply it all now. So it's no different as to whether you've been in or out and in again, or you're starting from scratch. But the point I was going to make was, and I'm sorry, but it comes back to the way that the staff have presented this, and certainly Ruth's comments to me support this, that it was either an IAS 29 amendment or an IFRS 1 amendment. And that is why the proposal in front of us was IAS 29, and then you certainly don't apply IFRS 1, which is why I voted no, because, and I think actually the way Ruth articulated it, she was implying you have to have an exception to IFRS 1, because she is of this, or was, perhaps having heard a discussion, and I'm not trying to put words into her mouth, of the same view that once you've got the IAS 29, that is superseding the IFRS 1, which is why I voted not no, I'm sorry, Bob, on the 29, because to me, it's one or the other, and the IFRS 1 on the decision that we made yesterday is the route to go.
Okay, Luca, would you like to come in?
Oh, yes. In my feeling, the item should be resolved inside the EAS 29 and not touch IFRS 1. I have some problem in the idea of application of IFRS 1, also considering the fact that we are looking to an application of a sort of fair value, even though the request is quite clear indicating that there are some economic elements that could be very, very relevant and could be element that would not permit the appropriate application of a fair value approach in order to determine which are the value to use for the first new year of application of IFRS. My opinion, I think that we have to choose and try to include all the items inside EAS 29 and try to make an effort in order to try to define which are the cases, and so try to define a definition of what is a chronic hyperinflation economy, because otherwise we could risk some abuse of this application an appropriate definition should be defined in order to be more sure of the appropriate application.
Okay, thanks for that. Scott, you took your light off, but yeah. Laurence?
Yeah, to respond to the staff concern, I mean, whatever the local gap figures are, they are local gap figures, and they would be reconciling to this if you apply IFRS 1. And I have still not understood what are the concerns of those who believe that if you have the IAS 29 amendment IFRS 1 shall not apply. I don't understand what is the problem.
Ruth?
Just to, and that's what I was going to say, so it's probably timely. The reason I think we have to specifically exempt them from IFRS 1 is that the staff recommendation as written in para 38A, B and C doesn't give the entity relief for the time when it was not preparing financial statements. It only deals with when I come back to preparing my financial statements, I can restate and I can go to the new currency, the US dollar or whatever, and I can prepare a new opening balance sheet. But it's missed out that period of time when the entity was saying, I can't comply with IFRS because I've got no basis, I can't prepare meaningful financial statements, I've got no numbers. So there is a period of time in which it is doing nothing, or it's saying, I'm not complying with IFRS. So that to me says it's gone out of IFRS. Then it's going to come back in, and ordinarily if we apply the rules or principles we came up with yesterday, we would say, okay, you are a repeat first-time adopter, you're in IFRS 1. In para 38D of the staff recommendation, they've said you mustn't apply IFRS 1, which I think is right, and I think it has to say that because that there's been a period where it hasn't been adopting IFRS. If you amended IAS 29 to say, in the periods when you were not preparing meaningful financial statements or you couldn't assert compliance with IFRS, something along the lines of, you get, and it's going back to Scott's original recommendation, you get some sort of buy in IAS 29, which is notwithstanding all of that, you can still assert compliance with IFRS under some provision in IAS 29, then the IFRS 1 issue goes away. But I think as the recommendation is drafted, that issue is still there, and that's why I believe we have to make the exception.
So even in the circumstances where the chronic hyperinflation has caused the entity to discontinue IFRS, it restores its financial sanity and it has a full comparative period that it's able to present in compliance with the IFRS. Doesn't immediately move back, not taking off the table the question about partial year comparatives or no comparatives. It waits until it has the complete set of financial statements in compliance with IFRS. And you would still say it shouldn't be permitted under those circumstances to use IFRS 1 for those first statements.
I'm saying that it would ordinarily have to use IFRS 1 because it had a period of asserting that it didn't comply with IFRS. So ordinarily, based on the amendment we approved yesterday, it would have to apply IFRS 1 because it's gone out of IFRS and it's coming back in. These amendments to IAS 29 deal with it coming back in and saying when you come back in, you can do this and you can do a new opening balance sheet. But they don't address the fact that for a number of years or however long it was in the wilderness doing nothing, presenting nothing, saying it's not complying. And that means to me it's one of those in, out, back in again situations. And so we have to do what 38D says, give the specific exemption.
So really what you're telling people is that if you're suffering from chronic hyperinflation, you shouldn't admit it, just go off IFRS, and then you get back in.
No, I'm saying...
Oh, I'm
no,
sorry, that's the consequence of what you're saying.
No, it's not. I'm saying that during that time, it has to say it's not complying with IFRS.
Like anybody else?
Yeah.
Like any company that just says, okay, I'm now not listed on a securities exchange any longer, I don't have to comply, there's no regulatory requirement, I go off. Coincidentally, I'm suffering from chronic hyperinflation, but I just don't assert compliance because I don't have to. So all of those unlisted companies come back at a point of time later, having gone through the same economic circumstance. They're permitted to adopt using IFRS 1, but the ones that were previously on it and had to say we came off because of chronic hyperinflation can't come in. It makes absolutely no sense to me whatsoever.
I'm saying if we support the staff recommendation, the staff are saying let's give them the relief through IAS 29.
Right. Well, we've already decided
on that. So IAS 29 gives them the relief, but when they come back on, they get the relief that they would have got somehow if they had applied IFRS 1, but we're giving them specific relief which says prepare your opening balance sheet on a fair value as deemed cost for everything. And I agree with Andrew's point earlier, I don't think we've covered everything. We could even say don't worry about comparatives if that's how far you want to go. but we have to give them the relief. And you're proposing to give them the relief in IS 29. You could just as well give it in IFRS 1. It's probably cleaner to give it in 29 because it's very specific to them, but we have to give them the relief. I think what we're doing here is we're giving them the equivalent relief that they would have got had they applied IFRS 1, but we're making it very specific to their circumstances through doing it through IS 29.
Well, I'm sorry, I just remind you that we're not giving them the relief just through IFRS 1 that they would have had unless we change IS 29, because we're changing IS 29. What I'm objecting to, and I'm sorry I'm not going to be able to come around and vote when this comes to the board, is that you're now proposing separately in IFRS 1 that we make an exception to exclude a certain category of people that meet the definition of a first-time adopter, unchanged definition of a first-time adopter, and to introduce an exception in there that says a certain category of people cannot use it. That is the amendment that you're wanting. The change, let me remind you, the change you proposed yesterday on IFRS 1 was that it is applicable, and we make it clear that it's applicable to everybody, and it's required to be used, who's using or presenting IFRS this year and didn't in the previous year assert compliance with IFRS. And everybody in that circumstance is required to use IFRS 1. Now you want an exception. Bernd? Bernd?
Yeah, well, I must say I agree with Ruth, because we're dealing here with in the proposed paragraph 38A deals with a very specific situation. It's not a widespread situation. It's an entity may discontinue the preparation because of blah, blah, blah. So this is a very specific situation. And then we amend IS 29, and then we say in 38D, and if this amendment applies to you because of 38A, you shall not apply IFRS 1. And I think that's okay, because we're not talking about giving them the opportunity to apply IFRS 1, but if we give them no exception, they have to apply IFRS 1, and I don't think that you can disconnect it, for example, from the comparators, because IFRS 1 says you shall give 3 years of comparators, which they can't, because they have no numbers at all. They're not on switching out of IFRS and going to local GAAP, but they have no numbers at all. And they can produce comparatives, and they must produce comparatives if we send them to IFRS 1. And they must use IFRS 1 if we don't exempt them. So this is a very narrow, specific group of people, and I think to accommodate this situation, we must give them, we must exclude them from IFRS 1. So I'm on Ruth's side here.
And that is what the staff have recommended. That's what you've said in para 30.
You're not on the mic. Sorry, you're not on the mic.
The reason for the staff recommendation being the way that it is precisely the fact that there is this hole in the track record, which is what Bernd and Ruth, you've both been describing. And because there aren't numbers for them to have a basis for transition using IFRS 1. Yeah. That is why we've proposed in the staff recommendation that we have a fresh start, but doing so through IS 29, using fair value as deemed cost as the starting point, because we've got a gap period of whether it's a few months or however long it might be, where there just isn't any reliable data to use as the track record from which to do a transition from a previous gap.
Sarah?
I was glad to hear Michael use the term fresh start, because that was how I viewed this when I was reading the staff's recommendation. It seemed that the situation was so extreme that in paragraphs 38 A, B, and C, we said, here's what you do in those circumstances, and that in effect gives you a fresh start. Because you're doing that, you don't fall within what IFRS 1 was designed to do, hence you don't follow it. So I don't really think it's an exception to IFRS 1. Rather, it's an alternative, more of a fresh start, because of these extreme circumstances. So I was actually fine with it. Hence, that means I agree with Bernd and Ruth.
Okay. I'm going to suggest we take a 15-minute coffee break now so the staff can consider the question that we're going to ask the committee. And so we'll resume at 10:45.